Hi everyone, and welcome back to Compassion in a T-shirt. I'm Dr. Stan Steindl, and today we have an incredibly special guest with us, Dr. Elijah Zimmerman, the Executive Director of the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion. Elijah's work is deeply rooted in compassion and leadership, and a career dedicated to spreading the transformative power of mindful self-compassion across the globe. Whether it's helping guide the growth of the CMSC or leading other impactful non-profit initiatives, Elijah brings a unique blend of wisdom, heart, and vision to everything he does. In a world that often feels rushed and disconnected and even terribly at odds at times, Elijah's work reminds us of the importance of slowing down, showing up, being kind to ourselves, and fostering a more compassionate community. I can't wait to dive into his journey, hear his insights on compassionate leadership, and learn how he and the team at CMSC are shaping the future of self-compassion practices. And so I bring you Dr. Elijah Zimmerman. Yes, well, welcome, Dr. Elijah Zimmerman, to Compassion in a T-shirt.
Yeah, thank you, Stan. Really nice to be here and in my T-shirt.
Yes, great. Good, me too, actually. I have compassion on the T-shirt. So, you've had a remarkable journey, really, in terms of leading various initiatives and so on. And I wondered if we could start there a little bit, if you could tell us a little bit about kind of you as a leader, you know, like what are your core values? What's your leadership style?
Yeah, glad to talk about that. I would say my leadership style is very much framed by my lived experiences and definitely rooted in a community awareness. I think that was very strongly instilled for me in growing up in a small farming community in which you just immediately recognize how interconnected everyone is for survival and also for like living your best life. You know, everyone needs to contribute and pitch in. And I further cemented some of that type of value when I was 17. I joined the military. And of course, in that environment, there's a lot of emphasis on resilience of the group. So one thing that's really strong for me is the resilience and the collaboration of the group and building leadership out of that sense of community. I think also my lived experiences, particularly academically, but also personally, I come from critical cultural, queer experiences. And in those elements as well, thinking about culture, thinking about belonging, about inclusion, really taught me the importance of intersectionality. So really thinking about, you know, each person you meet comes with their own unique story, their own unique experiences based on a wide variety of things and what it means to them to belong or participate. And so I really try to bring that kind of awareness of diverse thinking and experiences to whatever room I show up in. And I think that part of that is also touches on mindfulness. It's just being mindful of where you're at, who you're with. And in that, I think that's a way to action, a sense of dignity and respect. So that's pretty important to me, those components of intersectionality and dignity.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of this kind of group and the group kind of perspective, the individual perspective, how the individual can be part of the group, and it's sort of, you know, it kind of they sort of nurture each other, really, that sense of kind of the intersectionality and the person and the individual and how they can belong in the group. I've just lost your video, actually. Elijah, are you still there?
I am here. I don't know what happened there. There I am.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah.
That's cool. We can sort of edit all that out. But yeah, there's that sort of, it sort of, kind of goes both ways. The sort of the interconnectedness, the individual, and how the individual can kind of feel safely a part of the interconnectedness, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, connecting that to self-compassion, that's a really key component. Before I landed here, I've been practicing for quite a long time that idea of the self and the other, that interconnection, and how self-compassion, well, it really strengthens the resilience of the individual. It is in service of that relationship with others. So you're not existing in a vacuum on that. There's a lot of interaction that comes into play. And even for our own selves to be called, in to look at where we need self-compassion, that's usually because of some interaction we have had with someone else. So there's a lot happening there continually in reflection in our relationship to the world around us.
I think that's sometimes a misconception of self-compassion, isn't it? That it's all about the self. And obviously the further misconception is that it's therefore selfish or that sort of thing. But even sometimes people who are kind of, really sort of interested in self-compassion might confuse it as something that's really to do with the self. But actually, yeah, you make a important point that it's still in relationship with others and the world and so on. And sometimes self-compassion is important because of relational kind of experiences and so on. But even, kind of that notion of self-compassion furthering our sense of belonging and being a part of the group in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does all of that kind of inform your leadership more on a daily basis, or even kind of like a practical day-to-day basis in your role?
Yeah, I think importantly, one thing that's not part of my vision of a day-to-day operationalizing is anything fixed. I mean, as a human being, of course, I gravitate to things that I would like to be more stable or fixed. But I think, the awareness of co-creation, the awareness of adaptability and flexibility, particularly in a nonprofit environment, that's so important. Day to day, trying to show up with an openness, and I think I want to emphasize that frame of showing up. Showing up with mindfulness, showing up listening, just showing up to what is at hand, and really facing that with others in the most honest ways possible. I think that day-to-day effort can be difficult sometimes because as human people, I might have something else going on in my life where I go, gosh, I don't really feel like showing up today to be very open. But that's one of those values that I have or a commitment I've made to the people I work with. That I'm going to do that the best way that I can. And sometimes that means letting people know, oh, hey, this is going on in my life. So here's what I got to give today. And I just want you to know that's where I'm at. And sometimes it's not saying that and just being able to meet the moment and realizing when I can show up, things start to change. And it does change my day from how it started. And so I think there's a really strong component of openness. Curiosity. I think curiosity probably drives most of what I do. Within reason, trying to hold on to a few variables that you can lean into. But curiosity, I think, matches really well with compassion. And it helps me remember to lean in and to listen more than showing up with some fixed idea.
Yeah, it sort of makes the point, I guess, that our values are kind of aspirational. They're things that we work towards every day. You want to have that sense of, kind of inclusion and belonging and openness and so on. But then sometimes it's tricky. It's difficult. And so there's a kind of an authenticity piece, or maybe even a humility piece, perhaps, or something like that, that you're able to kind of acknowledge your own vulnerabilities or when things are happening, and so that will sort of also influence how the day goes a little bit. But being open, honest, sharing, curious about yourself, curious about others, trying to bring all that together. Do you have a little kind of morning routine or anything like that? I mean, how do you set the intention there to show up in those sorts of ways?
Yeah, I would say my general morning routine, and it can fluctuate when I start my workday just because we do have global connections. So I might start really early, or start a little bit later to balance that out. My general practice is at least have some space of quiet to start the day and to really have that space to move from, sleeping state to like, here I am in the world again, another day. And so a real, I would call it a like a gentle meditative practice to start, and then ensuring I've got at least some actual fuel, some type of food and my one cup of coffee for the day. It's my routine, that kind of, okay, everything is right in the world. I've got that. And yeah, it's pretty simple. I try to keep the start of my day very simple and quiet.
Simple and quiet and sort of grounding and just kind of steadying yourself, ready to show up, I guess, in those sorts of ways. I'm running a workshop next week about it's actually about a topic called motivational interviewing in leadership and sort of bringing that approach to leadership. And one of the things I've been kind of thinking about and slightly grappling with is when things do go wrong, when there are certain concerns or issues that arise, or when perhaps even a staff member is struggling with the work or with those sorts of things, and wanting to maintain a compassionate stance and at the same time kind of approach those issues and maybe even kind of create some sort of improvement there or change or those sorts of things. How do you approach that? How do you kind of hold those values and even taking a compassionate approach and kind of deal with some of the various day-to-day challenges that you might face? We've actually lost your video
Yeah,
there again.
I'm not sure what is happening here with this video. I've never had this problem before. Of course, that would be today. Okay.
That's all
Let's
good.
see if that, maybe we'll jump. That video is not working. Okay. Yeah, the spirit of your question, when things aren't going quite as planned, or
Or
there's
even
issues that you
providing,
can't.
corrective feedback in a way. How
Yeah.
does one, how do you manage that?
Yeah. I think one approach that I've found, and it's not a one size fits all. I think that's the major thing I've grown to understand is first really understanding the person that you're working with, what motivates them, and understanding their working style. For some people, you can kind of start to see, is this a question of anxiety? Is it a question of overwhelm? Maybe for others, is this a question they don't have the right information? So I think first understanding, as much as you can, a glimpse of what that might be about. And I think what I found works really well is to make that observation of, here's what I'm seeing and I'm wondering about. What can you tell me about that? Or is that resonating with you? Or tell me more about what's happening for you. And usually that shifts things pretty quickly in my experience, because it also offers that person a place to say, actually, this is happening for me right now, and why this is difficult, or I was feeling stress about the about this. So naming it generally already starts to shift it. I think the follow-up is important as well. And in that sense, what's compassionate is to have that structure, just to say, I want to follow up and note that I did hear you and see you. And here's a potential follow-up, we can do together, and then continue to get feedback. So there is a component of that structural piece, I think, that's really important in compassion. We can hold space for one another. We can witness. And then in a workplace, we need to find clarity and movement. And sometimes that's also not so easy in terms of when things are coming at you so quickly, how to create space for that clarity. But making efforts to that, I think, is also really important.
Yeah, there's sort of a kind of a there's sort of something preemptive in the relationship that you've already built, I guess. You're able to have those conversations in a way where you are able to kind of name certain things with the person, and perhaps partly that's to do with, kind of understanding the whole person, rather than just them in this moment on this task or something, but rather, understanding the whole person and the intersectionality of that person perhaps too comes in there, I guess, a little bit as well, and trying to understand that whole person, offer some thoughts, but also staying evocative, I guess, trying to listen well and explore, and then I guess, yeah, move forward with some things collaboratively a little bit, things that might improve. Does that sort of kind of sum up some of that?
Yeah, I think that captures it. And in my time of at least being executive director, I've been fortunate to work with really high performing, invested people. And so I think it's also really important to respect sort of the path, the work focus that those folks are on. I might have an idea about something, but if that's their domain and they're feeling an expert over it, likely they've got an insight or something I've not seen or been thinking about. And just being able to be open about, sharing together about is there a direction that this can go in differently than it is now? And then having that, like I think you were pointing out, to have that relationship established where someone will also feel comfortable pushing back and saying, actually, whatever you're looking at here, let me point you over here and why this is more important and being open to that. So definitely sort of dialogic, definitely in process. And it does, I think, from a leadership perspective, requires me to budget out more time to take that space to work with people. But I think it's well worth it in the end.
In actual fact, it's sort of preferable, isn't it, really, to be able to have those conversations in a funny sort of a way, to be able to give people feedback effectively and to help them kind of develop and grow is the compassionate thing. You know, if we avoid those conversations, then the person might sort of stay stuck in a way or something like that. And so there's a kind of a compassionate motivation in actually having nice, clear, open conversations that are safe and constructive.
Absolutely. So I think most people want to feel effectual in their work. And there's a lot of different pressures, in the work itself, but also personally, a person might be experiencing that are just part of being human, part of being a group, part of being alive. And just that can fluctuate, right? So I think most people want to know if there's something going on, whether they can address it immediately or not. At least that's going to be part of their field of vision so they can have some agency or choice about what happens next.
What's the role then of feedback for you too? How do you work with that?
I think the approach, at least currently what we have in our organization, I think people are very much encouraged to give me feedback or to say, no, I don't think that's going to work. Or did you look out at this over here? Or, I think it's important to have that environment where you try to work together to keep it more creatively open. And that includes myself. And I think, as a team, we try to work in more of a compressed hierarchy and just acknowledging that each one of us has different skills or responsibilities, and how can we do those best together, really in service of the mission. So it's less about, someone individually and more what are we accomplishing as a group.
I'm just sort of thinking out loud, but it's almost like compassion is, may I be helpful in a way, isn't it? And so one of the really useful things is to check, like, am I being helpful or something like that? And so to be able to offer feedback to staff, for example, then that kind of helps them to understand, kind of reflect and understand their own helpfulness. And then to receive feedback from them helps us, helps the leader to also kind of have a sense of their helpfulness as well. Do you find that at a workplace like the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, do you find that bringing compassion in like that as a leader is kind of like easy peasy, therefore, because it's sort of, everyone's kind of interested and committed to that, or are there sort of different challenges there in terms of the sort of the interaction between that you as a compassionate leader and compassionate staff?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a Rubik's Cube in a way, that
Okay,
question.
it
Yeah,
is.
in the sense that maybe pulling out what you said before, there's a bit of like, how can I help? May I help? People are very eager to help. And I think Then the one of the things that's needed is what boundaries are we holding with each other so that there's sort of a
Yeah.
clear line of this is mine to take responsibility for and take action on, and then to tell you how you can help, or ask if you can help rather. But when you're so busy and things are so compressed, I think it's that tricky environment. You're like, oh, the flood is coming and we need to throw some sandbags. Who's going to stop and say, can I, I'm just going to throw some sandbags on, and that is really helping. So there's a little bit of that happening, I think, in most nonprofits, right? Because people are there, they're motivated by their heart, they're motivated by the mission, they want to feel that sense of contribution. And so, there's a lot of space there to work with all the helpers. And maybe to be reductive, as we know, if you're in a kitchen with cooking, you can't have everybody cooking the same thing. So, I think sometimes it's important just to look at each other and remember who's responsible for what and have those boundaries. And I also think, importantly and like beneficially, in an environment working in compassion, there's really a space for people to show up in their full humanity. Maybe a little bit of pressure to show up in that sense of the light. And then what are we doing with our shadows if we're pulling out a Jungian sense of things? Because they're there as well. And when, we're in this environment where we're welcoming people to show up as their full self, that's going to get a little bit messy. And that's okay. I think that's, the biggest thing in this kind of environment. That's okay that it's getting a little messy. And let's just be aware that we're all working through these different levels of vulnerability together. That would be different if we were just making widgets or shoveling gravel or, name something that doesn't necessarily involve such a focus on our heart space.
Yes. Yeah, we're all sort of human after all, sort of thing. And so we come along with the full sort of wonderful chaos of that. And so it's funny, a lot of times when I've worked sort of training and other things with not-for-profits, I often observe a lean towards compassion for others, a sort of a helpfulness towards others, and a really quick and sort of strong desire to be helpful to others and so on. Do you find that that lean is still there in your organization, or given that it is the mindful self-compassion sort of organization, are people sort of more attentive to self-compassion or self-care in that environment?
I think it's a mix. I think it's an art. It's an ongoing balance, particularly because it's nonprofit oriented. And again, people are drawn to it to be helpful. So I think it's a feature of what we do that it's helpful to remember. Sometimes it's important to put your own oxygen mask on first, or in this situation, even though this boundary might be really uncomfortable, it's really important. For you to be able to do your work, for me to do my work, and for us to be generative and sustainable down the line. And sometimes that's quite uncomfortable. So I think, there's a lot of existing in that space of attunement to what is needed in every moment, and really being okay with being a bit uncomfortable about that. So I think our workplace is like similar, like a lot of workplaces focused on, human helping. My last role as an ED was in sexualized violence. And as you can imagine, in that role as well, there's a lot of sense of responsibility to show up for others. And with such heavy content, such layers of trauma, it's even more important that the people working in it know how to take that time and have boundaries for themselves. So I think anytime you're working on that human component towards alleviating suffering, you really have to be conscious of how you're caring for yourself.
Yeah, it's really managing those flows, isn't it, of compassion and kind of having balance across the flows and kind of looking after others, but also letting others look after you a little bit. And then also, of course, the self to self sort of compassion and kind of really trying to embody some of that, I guess, as a leader, embodying it and kind of modeling it and then kind of encouraging it amongst the team and trying to, but it's an ongoing, process and people shift about a little bit, I guess. And one of the things I sort of notice about you, I'm not wanting to sort of jump to make any assumptions, but you do seem to be a very calm person, I guess. There's something about calmness, maybe too, that if we can sort of keep the body a little bit down regulated and calm and feel safe, then that's how we can start to really approach and work with these different flows.
Well, I think that's really apt in the sense that, as we know, a lot of science would say the more regulated you are, the more oxygen you're getting, the more brain power you can have. And also, you can sit in that discomfort and let things settle and sometimes organically emerge for the solution, right? We can get ourselves in trouble sometimes when, out of anxiety, we're trying to push an answer. When sometimes it just needs a bit of space for the right thing to emerge. It's one of the things I enjoy about working in a nonprofit is all the creative problem solving. And together, if we can, give it the space a problem has for the solution, and then you find that just beautiful, creative next step, that's extremely rewarding. And I think, people really appreciate that. You can see that build and just having that time. When you're talking about that calm spaciousness, to be able to see that is really helpful.
Those moments really are sort of goosebump moments, aren't they? When we're there, we're sort of holding space, we're showing up, as you say, we're kind of respecting each other and understanding each other as the whole person and all that sort of stuff. And then we bring our attention to a problem and gradually, something arises and kind of there it is. There's the I mean, I'm almost having little goosebumps even thinking of it, but it's sort of a it's a special moment when we can bring our collective minds and hearts to those sort of situations.
Yeah. And I think partly what you're speaking to, the excitement or beauty of that is that that can sometimes, come through when people are really working hard in the sense of being open. And I think that sometimes takes a lot of care and a lot of mindfulness, really, to be able to show up, and particularly in a work environment. I mean, we all have those pressures, right? On any given day, someone might say something that just you just feel like you can't get over it. Until you get a good night's sleep and you're like, oh, actually, that wasn't a big deal. Or, something disappointing happens that you've been working so hard for and it's not going to pan out. How to show up again with a sense of openness. So, I feel really fortunate I work in this environment with people who get that. They get there could be setbacks, they get there can be disappointments, they get that it's not going to always feel perfect, and that's okay. We're going to find a pathway forward.
There's a real courage piece too, isn't there? I'm noticing a few C words, good C words like caring and careful and curiosity and courage and compassion. Those are the sorts of some of the real pillars that can sort of hold up this effectiveness within the organization. Speaking of which, the CMSC, I mean, you've been involved in a lot of great initiatives. Actually, when was it that CMSC was first established?
I think the first teacher training, there's a little bit of a, depending on who you ask, 2013, 2014. And then we were incorporated as a nonprofit in 2015. So we're just about that 10-year zone. And it's an incredible growth from the start of a few important teacher trainings to what we're offering now.
I was at the or at a 2014 Joshua Tree 5-day, I think, intensive with Kristen and Chris and Christy Arbin. And yes, that was a peak experience certainly for me with coming to Joshua Tree and sitting around on a in a circle on cushions and kind of just really feeling it and experiencing it. But yes, the CMSC has had really some great initiatives and so on. I mean, tell us about some of the recent projects maybe, or some of the recent developments, things that you're perhaps excited about.
Yeah, excuse me. I think recently, maybe I'll just anchor this with, one of the things I think we are all just feel so good about is our circles of practice, which is that anyone is welcome to attend. We've got practices daily, and these are offered by volunteer teachers. And in these meditation time blocks, really deep communities have formed of care, for people with one another. I think that's a really important part of our mission, to be able to support that type of access. We also offer, array of like public program people can do workshops, or our, entry point, our live online mindful self-compassion, really available for everyone. And then this last year, we've identified some key areas, and I'll put that under the umbrella of, focusing on training people to train other people. So really there's that multiplier effect. So that means recommitting to our focus on teacher training and how we might make those pathways stronger and more beneficial for those taking teacher training. And then also recently we've looked at our self-compassion and psychotherapy curriculum and tried to make that more accessible in terms of cost and time for psychotherapists who want to learn more about those practices and then to share in their worlds with their clients and colleagues. And then quite recently, we've identified the importance of trying to work with private contracts in healthcare, education, and also workplaces in general. So in that sphere, I think one thing that's really exciting is that we're working with a group of people that might already work together. And so again, in community together, they can take these skills and mindful self-compassion and support one another, and then also offer it, for example, in healthcare to their patients in whatever way it might work, or in education to their students, and also just workplaces in general to, create greater wellness in places where people work together. So I think, having our eye on just that sense that you were talking about, Kristen was advocating earlier. How do we get this work out so that others may benefit more? And I think the initial idea with starting teacher training was just that. Let's have people train in this so they can share it where they're at. And then those people who learn can share. Really trying to stay focused on how we can do that internally right now.
It was really quite clever, wasn't it, from the beginning, the way that sort of training pathways were established, and I think there was a yeah that really sort of gave a shot in the arm to dissemination, sort of right from the start. And could you tell us a bit more about the circle of practice? I was just curious to that's an online sort of a thing.
It is, yeah. And they started in many ways. The sort of kickoff, if you will, was the pandemic. And Steve Hickman, the executive director at the time, said, we have an opportunity here to meet people where they're suffering. Could we get a group of teachers together and offer sort of daily practices where people can attend for free, just to find different tools for resilience during this time? And that's continued since the pandemic in 2020, led by some very experienced and thoughtful teachers. Again, some people will come daily. They've been coming for 4 years, to these practices with one another and being present and really finding a lot of value. But for anyone who would be interested, this is a great way to learn more about self-compassion and how it might benefit your life. It's free, it's accessible because it's online. We do it across time zones. And so it's a real opportunity to just get a sense of what mindful self-compassion could be for you.
Yeah, what it might be and what it might sort of feel like too, I guess, in a way, just to the sort of a very experiential entry point,
Yes.
I guess. And it doesn't require previous training and so on. It really is sort of available for anybody who would like to maybe get started and see what it's like. Yeah.
Yeah, I like your emphasis there on experiential, because I think you could pick up a book, and read different practices and do them by yourself. And I would say a lot of the people, when we talk to them about the efficacy of this work, it is about doing it in a community. If you're taking a course with a group of people or a meditation with groups of people, it is that sense of shared practice, shared belonging. It really has a benefit to do that with others.
I really am. One of the takeaways for me today is really that idea of self-compassion in community, in a sense. It's a funny thought in a way, but it also makes complete sense too. The notion of self-compassion in a community. If people are then to move on to the sort of the live online MSC, is that the MSC program itself then that people can do online?
Yes, it is. And we right now offer two of these courses start a month, and we try to stagger them again in time zones, so it makes it a little bit more accessible for people to access, depending on where they are in the world or their, work schedule. And so that would be a great entry point if you wanted to get a bit deeper. We also, at least every other month, have workshops. So if you're really looking, you've got a short window of time and you want to check something out a bit more, you can also take those courses, and they're quite intro oriented.
Yes, I remember sort of back in the day to do the 8-week course was sometimes challenging, especially from here in Australia, to sort of get somewhere to do it and then to be there for 8 weeks and so on. That's why I did that kind of 5-day intensive thing. But to have access to that online, it still remains. Is it 2 hours, 8 sessions?
Yes, so it's eight sessions, and then there's a short, I shouldn't say short, but there is a retreat, like a mini retreat, that also takes place as part of that component.
It's somewhere in the middle, I think, that the
Yes.
short retreat. Yeah. And then that's a prerequisite for teacher training.
It is a prerequisite for teacher training. Also, a prerequisite for teacher training is a silent retreat. So we like to see that you've incorporated some of the skills in an intro course, and then you've taken that time in a silent retreat for a week to sit with yourself and practices, so that you're prepared to enter a teacher training process. And that's an 8-week process. And then we've got, after that, a teacher training practicum in which people will also learn more specific practices in teaching.
There's kind of a co-training sort of process there in the practicum.
Yeah, how it breaks down is a person will be led by experienced teacher trainers, and then that individual gets a chance to teach a bit in sort of a smaller cohort within that larger training.
And that could be done in an online program or that sort of thing if there's no one geographically nearby, I guess, and there's a
Yeah.
process that that gets
Well,
allocated and so on.
yeah, almost exclusively all our programming is online right now. We're slowly trying to look at how to weave in some more in-person options. Right now, we've consistently had a 5-day in-person for the intro course in Sedona, Arizona, which will be happening again next March 2025. And we're also looking at, potentially another in-person in the fall for people to attend. This past year, we've done two live online teacher trainings, and we have one in person coming up at the end of this month. So we're trying to mix it up a little bit to meet the different needs or interests of the students.
There's sort of pros and cons to both, I guess, isn't there? Like the online stuff is really great for a sense of accessibility and that sort of thing, and also a kind of sense of international community and so on. And then the face to face is, just has that, it just sort of supercharges a little bit that sense of the relationship amongst each other, but it's much more difficult sometimes to get to and those sorts of things. When mindful self-compassion began, it was more of a community program in a sense. Whereas it's begun to be more a part of psychotherapy, as you mentioned. Where is that up to really in terms of MSC applied, as part of a therapy, for example?
That's a good question. I think probably folks to best answer that are the, people who've gone through the self-compassion psychotherapy program and how they're, weaving that into their work. I will say, the feedback that I've heard about those previous years' programs, a lot of it too is about the peer connections that are built through that process. And you probably have a sense of this in your own work. Having that sense of community or like case consultation to reach out to someone and to think about how you could apply mindful self-compassion for a particular client or, particular group. I think I've heard people, speak highly about having those connections and that shared sense of what the work is. But that's probably a great, a next guest you could have is someone who works in that, if I can
I think
plug somebody else.
that's a good idea, actually. Yes, I should explore that because I imagine one of the things that MSC, I suppose there's assessment definitely that there's the self-compassion scale, so there's sort of an element there of kind of assessment. Formulation is probably the other part of therapy that MSC isn't as kind of focused on, I think, but we might formulate a sort of a psychotherapy kind of client or that sort of thing, and then sort of see where MSC can be brought to that formulation perhaps, and some of the practices there. But yeah, it sounds like the kind of fairly exciting new developments is in kind of bringing MSC to healthcare, to education, sort of doing some of those programs, running programs within organizations. How's that part of it going?
Yeah, I think, we're learning every time we do it about, different groups and their different needs. I think in some ways, part of what's asked of us in doing this is to make it a bit bespoke, if you will, a bit tailored. And, that's really what people are looking for. They say, I've identified this need in my organization, in my group, and we want to focus just on this. How can you work with us? So that takes a bit of time and back and forth and figuring that out. And, much like I was talking about working all together, there's a bit of a co-creation that happens that necessarily takes a bit of time. We're certainly looking for, more ways to connect to groups who are already, committed to wellness and they're wanting to add another tool. So we're in process, I would say, at this is a first phase of how this can unfold.
Yeah, cool. All right. I mean, one of the things that I certainly notice, I am sort of involved too in compassion-focused therapy as a sort of a kind of close cousin of MSE, I guess, or whatever. And one of the things we might identify is those fears, blocks, and resistances to self-compassion, and self-compassion is too much like self-pity or too self-indulgent. I know Kristen talks a lot about how to work with some of those obstacles of self-compassion. What are your thoughts there? Like, what might you sort of say to someone who feels some of that? Is feeling a bit like, self-compassion sounds a bit too much like self-pity. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I kind of think about self-pity as a more static state in which you're really isolating. You're not really making any movement on a particular feeling, where I see self-compassion as really action-oriented. It's taking initiative to, witness yourself, hold yourself with care, and it's in a service as of I've been talking about. I think in relationship of compassion more generally. So self-pity feels like it doesn't really go any further than individual in many ways, where self-compassion has that possibility to be relational, be agentic, have opportunity to have movement in your state of being.
And movement towards sort of health and well-being, isn't it? I guess, in a sense, self-pity can if there is that concept, self-pity feels like it's a bit more stuck, a bit more kind of bogged down, a bit more inward focus. Self-compassion really invites us to think what might be helpful. What could I do in the service of my health and well-being? And not only that, but it's sort of outward looking as well, and thinking about, kind of community. So sort of to wrap up, and just a bit of a fun question, I think, but well, I think it's fun. If you could design, like a completely new self-compassion type practice that you could kind of, get out there to sort of the into the minds and hearts of everyone, like what would it be? What would you think of there?
I think, wonderfully, this practice in some ways it's very simple, it's very portable, you can adapt it to a lot of different contexts. So in that way, I don't think it'd be anything new per se, but I do think it can really be helpful in what I would call right now more existential crises, that we're all kind of being faced with in terms of climate change or economic uncertainty, or even globally, different factors, related to conflict. I think if we can apply mindful self-compassion to those questions of existential meaning making, it actually can help us focus and build some resilience in the face of all the uncertainty. And first and foremost, in that sense of common humanity, is saying we're all experiencing this, so please don't feel alone with yourself. It would be, reasonable as a human being to feel some array of emotions about all of these, bigger things happening. And of course, we're seeing in the news, different thinkers, everyone's trying to think of how do we meet the challenges of this moment. And it is a lot of external action taking. And I think the more we can create resilience for ourselves to show up for that in the uncertainty, it's really important. Because these bigger questions, I think, really can push burnout really quickly. Which is another great place for me to share. Chris Germer and Kristen Neff have a new book on burnout coming out just this month, and they'll be doing a workshop for us next month. I think that's really timely. It's really important as part of these bigger pictures of, how do we fortify ourselves to meet this moment of uncertainty.
Gosh, there's so much going on, isn't there, at the moment? It's sort of really difficult to think about. But yeah, the sort of around the world and online, it just seems so kind of just so much adversarial kind of communication and attacking the person and I'm sort of struggling with some of that myself, and yet, yeah, that there's just so much wisdom in those three bits, isn't there? That the mindfulness, the common humanity, the self-kindness. I mean, that it just really rings true. There's something. It's such a gift, from Kristen, I guess, really, who kind of developed that model. And if we think about, yeah, sort of the new bit is kind of like, or the bit you're suggesting is, yeah, how to bring that. Those three components and self-compassion generally to those really existential kind of concerns that we're all facing.
I think the challenge or the opportunity with that is, how do we get more people to, look at these, fairly, on the face of it, three simple things to remember, that you're saying you could apply to your life to really, create some more stability for yourself. How do we make that invitational to different groups of people? And relationally, how do we become invitational about sharing this work? That's a lot of what's on my mind, in terms of CMSE and just generally when we think about practices that alleviate suffering and support well-being. How can we be the most invitational to others as possible?
Invitational. Yeah, that's good. It's sort of, yeah, it's kind of spreading the word, but it's kind of this invitation to everyone, really, to explore it and try it out and maybe even experience it and jump online and see what you think. It's quite funny because this particular YouTube channel or podcast is all about compassion and self-compassion and so on. But even here, I get the trolls sometimes, like coming in and sort of making sort of angry comments and things like that. And but yeah, we're really wanting to just kind of be invitational, just putting it out there and sort of, obviously respecting choices and so on. But this is available and it works and it helps. And let's see. Let have people kind of try it out. Well, you've been joined there by a little friend, which
I
is quite
have.
adorable.
Yes, this is Ginger, who's telling me it is about 5 p.m. here, and there's things that have to happen at 5 p.m. called eating.
Eating, right. Eating and walk time or something
Sorry
like
about that.
that. Well, that's that. Thank you then for the little. I didn't quite catch the name. What was it?
Ginger.
Ginger. Yes, thank you, Ginger, for just giving us that little signal. And I was going to sort of say thank you very much. It's really been very informative. I love that stuff about sort of leadership and the approach there, and really embodying compassion and self-compassion in leadership. And then it's exciting to think all of the different opportunities that CMSC kind of offer us. So thank you very much for coming and speaking with me on Compassion in a T-shirt.
Thank you, Stan. I really appreciate it. Nice to chat with you.
Thank you.